You are now listening to Justice Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Justice Lit. We are back after a long break. I think it's the first time back in over a month. I went to go visit some family in Korea and went to go travel in Japan as well. And so, yeah, it was a hectic, exciting, and comforting past month. And so I hope everyone's also having a good summer. The weather in Vancouver is currently amazing, and so I'm just super excited to be back. And we'll get things rolling with some more Shakespeare today. But before we do that, I have some ads, show promos, and PSAs. And one song from Vern Chichu called Young Eagle Called. And so after that, we'll get right into the Shakespeare readings. So we'll be right back after that.
Welcome to Lethal Refresh.
I'm Danny.
I'm B.
I'm Stuff.
I'm Jay.
Let's get lethal. Let's get refreshed. When it's darkest, we always attract the brightest people. Baby, you a
light. You shift my whole world to the right. Please listen to Lethal Refresh on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Nardor the Human Serviette and Doo-doo-loo-doo.
Thank you!
Lethal Refresh, every Monday, 12 to 1 p.m. New music every week.
Re-20, T-20. Take some, you take that one. I get E-son. Rocking in my little tie. Yeah.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read. Are you looking to decolonize your self-care routine? Take a trip down to Sisters Sage for a variety of handmade soaps, bath fizzies, smudge sprays, and salves infused with traditional plant medicines. Sisters Sage is an award-winning local Indigenous business run by Tsimshian and entrepreneur, activist, and community builder Lynn Marie Angus and her dog TJ. Passionate about crafting wellness products that are respectful of the land we live on, Sisters Sage is committed to a heart-centered approach to self-care, as well as our collective healing. Located on 1312 Kingsway, you can drop by from Monday to Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. See you there.
Hey Vancouver, looking for your summer plans? MRG Live has you covered. Catch Caroline Kingsbury, and Maris, Emotional Oranges, and many more live on stage. Don't miss out. Grab your tickets now at www.admit1.com and follow at MRG Live Official on Instagram for fresh announcements and the full lineup of upcoming shows.
Young eagle call, I call out your name, took you on home, never see you again. You were too young to die, too young to go. You had places to see, music to hear, and stories to tell. We just never know. We just never know. In store, you were a man on the moon, and tearing down walls, breaking trail for the young, and for the people you love. A true warrior who stood for what he believed, right to the end. That's what I saw in you, and I miss you, my friend. You've been, and I
never known. Yes, your memory will never die. What you leave behind shall live on. Young eagle called, I call out your name, took you on home, never to see you again.
Welcome back. That was some ads shown problems PSAs and Young Eagle Called by Vern Chichu. We'll get right into Sonnet 105. Let not my love be called idolatry, nor my beloved as an idol show, since all alike my songs and praises be to one of one still such and ever so. Kind is my love today, tomorrow kind, still constant in a wondrous excellence, therefore my verse to constancy confined. One thing expressing leaves out difference. Fair, kind, and true is all my argument. Fair, kind, and true varying to other words. And in this change is my invention spent, three themes in one, which wondrous scope affords. Fair, kind, and true have often lived alone, which three till now never kept seat in one. Now, for lines 1 and 2, these opening two lines immediately defend the speaker's love from accusations of idolatry, which is a term that implies not only excessive admiration, but also a religious heresy, where the worship of a false god or object is seen to be in place. Now, Shakespeare, the speaker, rejects the framing of this and insists that their devotion is not misplaced or irrational. And we could also see a bit of a self-awareness here, in a sense where to write, to repeatedly write, and an excessive praise for a beloved can ultimately resemble worship, and also the speaker wants to preempt such a charge. And so we see a bit of this in the opening two lines. With lines 3 and 4, here the speaker emphasizes singularity and also constancy, where all poems are written for one person who remains the same over time. In terms of form, the rhythm of to one of one, still such and ever so, this enacts the very sameness of what was mentioned before in an almost incantatory, which kind of loops back on itself. And we could also see a paradox here, where the poems may repeat the same line, but the speaker presents that constancy as a virtue, not a limitation. With lines 5 and 6, we see a reiteration of the beloved's unwavering qualities. The repetition of kind mirrors the poem's larger theme of constancy, which includes emotional and moral side and the poetic side. The phrase wondrous excellence, in a sense, elevates this trait to something almost into something almost divine, suggesting that unwavering goodness is itself a marvel. With lines 7 and 8, we see a claim about form and content, where the poetry is constrained in the phrase confined by the very constancy it describes. The phrase leaves out difference reinforces the idea that there's no need for variation when the subject is so unwavering. But however, this also courts monotony, a danger, some sort of danger the poem later addresses. With lines 9 to 10, the speaker now reduces the beloved to a triad of virtues, which is fair, kind, and true. And so these become the poem's, I guess, fixed intention, in a sense. And so even when the poet changes the language, these core values remain. And the recursive structure again emphasizes repetition with difference, where the same meaning is, where even though there's the same meaning, it kind of varies in expression. Lines 11 to 12, we are presented with a paradox that is made explicit. The poet claims to exhaust his poetic invention on a single subject. Yet this limitation paradoxically gives quote-unquote wondrous scope, which suggests that even within the bounds of three virtues, the three virtues being fair, kind, and true, the possibilities for poetic rearticulation are vast. And this is a subtle argument for poetic constraint as generative. The closing couplets of lines 13 and 14, we are presented with a final claim that these virtues, the three virtues, have never before existed together in a single person. And so this elevates the beloved to a kind of platonic ideal, an embodiment of perfect moral and aesthetic harmony. And the phrase, never kept seat in one, imagines these abstract qualities as wayward entities finally united in the beloved. And the beloved is not just an ideal or idol, but an incarnation of something higher. And so that was Sonnet 105. Moving on to Sonnet 106. When in the chronicle of wasted time, I see descriptions of the fairest whites, and beauty making beautiful old rhyme in praise of ladies dead and lovely knights. Then in the blazon of sweet beauty's best, of hand, of foot, of lip, of eye, of brow, I see their antique pen would have expressed even such a beauty as you master now. So all their praises are but prophecies of this our time, all you prefiguring. And for they looked but with divining eyes, they had not skill enough your worth to sing. For me, which now behold these present days, have eyes to wonder but lack tongues to praise. Beautiful poem here. Now, moving on to lines 1 to 4, the speaker begins by reflecting on the quote-unquote the chronicle of wasted time, a phrase that invokes history or old literature, but also suggests a sense of decay or loss or vanity, and we could see that in the phrase wasted. The term fairest whites refers to beautiful people in both men and women, but who are now dead. And so fairest whites kind of implies dead men and women who are beautiful. The speaker notes how beauty inspired and enlivened old poetry, which praises these noble and lovely figures, yet the admiration feels both nostalgic and critical, where the glory of the past is acknowledged, but it is also implied to be lacking something. With lines 5 to 8, we kind of shift into a blazon, a literary mode that basically catalogs the parts of the beloved's body in detail. The speaker is observing how older poets, in praising physical features such as the hand, foot, lip, and eye, and brow, as we read before, seem to have been reaching toward a beauty that they could not fully know. The word blazon also suggests heraldry, where beauty is seen as emblematic, noble, and worthy of honor. Importantly, the speaker claims that their antique pen would have expressed such a beauty as you master now. This introduces a temporal inversion where the beloved's present beauty is so ideal that it retroactively fulfills the meaning of old poetic praise. We could see that the beloved is not just like the past ideal, but the ideal that the past unconsciously anticipated. With lines 9 to 12, the key idea here in these couple lines, or several lines, is that the past poets were prophetic. Their praise, though seemingly about others, was really about you, or the beloved. The term divining eyes emphasizes this, where they could sense beauty but not fully grasp it. They were like seers or oracles, glimpsing future truth but unable to articulate it in full. Their lack of skill, not of feeling but of expressive adequacy, renders their attempts beautiful yet insufficient. And so that is significant with these lines. The final two lines, we're kind of presented with another painful paradox, or a paradox in general. The speaker and their contemporaries can see the beauty fully, but they are still mute before it, where they lack tongues to praise. There's a sense of aesthetic failure or speechlessness in these two lines, where despite having the object that the past longed for, the present is no more capable of capturing it in words. And so that was Sonnet 106. Before we move on to Sonnet 107, I have one song for you guys to play. Again, from Vern Chichu. It is called Take Me Back to the Weekend. So we'll be right back after this.
Take me back, back to
That was Take Me Back to the Weekend. Moving on to Sonnet 107. Not mine own fears, nor the prophetic soul of the wide world dreaming on things to come, can yet the lease of my true love control, supposed as forfeit to a confined doom. The mortal moon hath her eclipse endured, and the sad augurs mock their own presage. Incertainties now crown themselves assured, and peace proclaims olives of endless age. Now with the drops of this most balmy time, my love looks fresh, and death to me subscribes. Since spite of him I'll live in this poor rhyme, while he insults over dull and speechless tribes. And though in this shalt find thy monument, when tyrants' crests and tombs of brass are spent. In lines 1 to 4 here, Shakespeare opens with a declaration of resistance, not his own personal fears, nor the collective foresight of the quote-unquote prophetic soul of the world can determine the fate of his love. And so the word lease suggests a legal or temporal contract, where his love, like life, is not eternal, but it cannot be ended. The phrase confined doom hints at death or fate. His love is thought to be bound to eventual destruction, but it is not yet forfeited. The phrase prophetic soul of the wide world evokes a kind of global, almost mystical awareness, the collective premonitions of humanity that still cannot override love's staying power. And so he sets up a powerful paradox, a paradox that even though everything suggests love, ultimately must die. And so this includes personal fear, fate, or public prophecy. And so even though everything suggests love, must die, and it endures. And so that was lines 1 to 4. Lines 5 to 8. This quatrain kind of turns from personal to a political or cosmic imagery. The phrase mortal moon can be seen as a symbol of human changeability or fate. as it has passed through its eclipse, a dark period. Sad augurs, or gloomy prophets, are discredited. They mock their own predictions, which have proven false. The reversal of expectation continues with the phrase, "Uncertainties now crown themselves assured, and what was once unsure is now triumphant." The phrase, "Peace proclaims olives of endless age," invokes the olive branch as a symbol of enduring peace, possibly reflecting the end of a real-world conflict. Some interpret this sonnet as a reflection or reflecting the political optimism after Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Elizabeth's death, or the return of peace after political turmoil. And so, together, these lines depict a world where fate has shifted, and negativity and fear have proven misguided. With lines 9 to 12, here Shakespeare turns to poetry as immortality. For example, in the phrase, "This most balmy time," suggests a period of peace or relief, and love seems newly rejuvenated. Death is personified and forced to subscribe to the poet, acknowledging defeat. And the phrase, "I'll live in this poor rhyme," modestly names the poem itself as the speaker's medium of survival. The contrast here is pretty stark. He will speak through poetry, while death can only insult or reign over the dull and speechless tribes, the dead who have no voice. The final couplet is kind of a promise that the beloved will also live on through the poem. The phrase "monument" here is not made of stone or brass, but language. The image of tyrants, crests, and tombs of brass evokes military and royal grandeur, in the traditional way of being remembered. But those monuments decay, unfortunately, when they are quote-unquote spent. The beloved will still live on these lines. And so that was Sonnet 107. We'll move on to Sonnet 108. "What's in the brain that ink may character, which hath not figured to thee, my true spirit? What's new to speak, what now to register, that may express my love or thy dear merit? Nothing sweet, boy, but yet, like prayers divine, I must each day say over the very same, counting no old thing old, thou mine, I thine, even as when first I hallowed thy fair name. So that eternal love in love's fresh case weighs not the dust and injury of age, nor gives to necessary wrinkles place, but makes antiquity for aye his page, finding the first conceit of love there bred, where time and outward form would show it dead." Here in lines 1 and 2, the lines begin with a rhetorical question about poetic exhaustion. What is left in the poet's mind that could still be written and hasn't already been communicated to the beloved? And so that's the question that kind of is being raised here. The metaphor of character, as in to inscribe or engrave, casts writing as a physical act of imprinting. But the deeper concern is that nothing in the speaker's thoughts or soul has gone unrepresented. It's all already been figured to thee or shaped and presented to the beloved. Moving on to lines 3 and 4, the poet presses the same dilemma, where the question of this, "Is there anything new to say that can match the depth of my love or the worth of the beloved?" And so the repetition of "what now" builds a sense of urgency and futility. And here, so the idea here is that true love may resist novelty. The beloved's merit is constant, the speaker's love is unchanging. But poetry, by convention, thrives on new conceits. And so lots of questions about, like, so what can the poet do is being risen in these several lines. Lines 5 and 6, we are pivoted kind of beautifully here, where the speaker answers his own question. Nothing new can be said, but like daily prayers, the repetition itself becomes sacred. And so even if the words do not change, their recurrence is devotional and necessary. The simile of prayers divine elevates poetic repetition into a spiritual ritual. Love poetry here is not innovation, but liturgy, which affirms, reassures, and sanctifies. With lines 7 and 8, love renews itself through repetition. The phrase "counting no old things old" suggests that in love the passage of time does not diminish meaning or effect. Seeing, quote unquote, "thou mine, I thine," over and over never loses its charge. And the phrase "hallowed" emphasizes reverence, where the speaker first blessed the beloved's name, and that first gesture continues to reverberate. There's a bit of a fusion of the erotic and poetic and religious registers here, where the naming the beloved's, just the act of naming the beloved becomes an act of consecration. With lines 9 to 12, the poet returns to the paradox of timelessness in temporal love. The phrase "love's fresh case" means its present form or appearance, which is still fresh despite the passage of time. Eternal love does not weigh or consider the dust and injury of age. Dust evokes decay, injury suggesting the harm time inflicted on the body or on feeling. With lines 11 to 12, here love does not give wrinkles any room. And so the phrase "necessary" underscores that aging is inevitable, but love will not yield to it. Instead, love turns antiquity into a page, not something to fear, but something to write upon, preserve, or learn from. The metaphor of antiquity as a page returns to the writing theme, where even age can serve as a poetic vehicle when animated by eternal love. The final two lines in the poem, we are offered with a resolution. Even where time and outward form suggest love is dead, the first conceit is rediscovered and still alive. And so conceit here blends the poetic and the emotional together, where love is an idea, an imaginative spark, and as well as an enduring affection. And so that was Sonnet 108. Moving on to Sonnet 109. "Oh, never say that I was false of heart, though absence seem my flame to qualify, as easy might I from myself depart, as from my soul which in thy breast doth lie. That is my home of love, if I have ranged. Like him that travels, I return again, just to the time, not with the time exchanged, so that myself bring water for my stain. Never believe, though in my nature reigned, all frailties that besiege all kinds of blood, that it could so preposterously be stained, to leave for nothing all thy sum of good. For nothing this wide universe I call, save thou my rose, in it thou art my all." So that was Sonnet 109. With what lines 1 and 2 here, the speaker begins with a direct plea of the phrase, "Oh, never say." And this is seen as a charged imperative that establishes the urgency of defending its truth. or defending his truth. He asks not to be accused of infidelity, even though physical absence may have made his love appear diminished. The word qualify here suggests not only to lessen, but also to put conditions upon, as if his love might seem contingent, where in fact it is absolute. With lines 3 and 4, these two lines reinforce the unity of the self with the beloved. The speaker likens departing from the beloved to leaving his own self. And the soul is not just connected to the beloved. It resides in them. With lines 5 and 6, the speaker acknowledges the possibility of ranging, but frames it as innocuous travel, not betrayal. And the phrase, "that is my home of love," returns us to a metaphor of dwelling, where the beloved is a domestic center, and also could be seen as a grounding space. The phrase, "like him that travels," distances the speaker from the idea of abandonment, where travel is temporary and he returns again, restoring the constancy of affection. Line 7 and 8. The phrase, "just to the time," suggests he has returned punctually, not with the time exchanged, meaning that he hasn't changed with time and hasn't been transformed or corrupted by it. The second line, "bring water for my stain," implies atonement, and the speaker offers a purifying gesture, in a sense a baptism, to cleanse any perceived sin or transgression. With lines 9 to 10, the speaker here concedes his human susceptibility to desire and error, frailties that are universal, and the use of reigned suggests that these weaknesses have some power or control over him, but he asks the beloved not to believe that these frailties have led him astray. With lines 11 to 12, he insists that despite his weaknesses, it would be preposterous, even irrational, even unnatural, for his love to be so corrupted as to forsake the beloved's worth for nothing. The final couplet here kind of delivers an intense distillation feeling. The universe is nothing, utterly void except for the beloved. The metaphor "my rose" echoes other sonnets and evokes beauty, delicacy, and singularity. The speaker's world is entirely constituted by the beloved. The phrase, "in it thou art my all," is what does so. And this couplet seems a bit hyperbolic, but sincere, kind of drawing on the language of courtly and spiritual devotion, and collapsing all value and meaning into the beloved's presence. So that was Sonnet 109. We have another song called "Blonde-Haired, Blue-Eyed Indian Girl" by, of course, by Vern Chichu, and so we'll be right back after this.
French girl from the east, her dad a Musquatchy Cree. She loves to powwow all night long. She loves to hear and sing them powwow songs. She ain't white, she ain't red,
just a blonde haired, a blue eyed Indian girl. Just a blonde haired, blue eyed Indian girl. Hey, hey, way high, ah, hey, high, ah, way high, ah, high, ah, high, ah, hey, high, way high, ah, hey, high, ah, way high, ah, high, ah, high, ah, hey, high, way high, ah, way high, out on the western plains, out on Hobima Lane. She drives a Chevy pickup truck, eagle feather hanging from the mirror. She loves to powwow all night long. She's a proud Hobima Cree.
That was, we just finished listening to Blonde-Haired, Blue-Eyed Indian Girl. Something went wrong with the computer system here, I'm not sure, but I think that's going to be it for today. We only have time for the 109, but before we end it off for today, I'll just kind of read the sonnet 110. And kind of analyze it our next episode. And so I'll just give this one a read for you guys. Alas, 'tis true, I have gone here and there, and made myself a motley to the view, gored mine own thoughts, sold cheap what is most dear, made old offenses affections new. Most true is that it is that I have looked on truth, askance and strangely, but by all above, these blenches gave my heart another youth. And worse essays proved thee my best of love. Now all is done. Have what shall have no end. Mine appetite I never more will grind on newer proof to try an older friend. A god in love to whom I am confined. Then give me welcome next my heaven the best, even to thy pure and most loving breast. And that was Sonnet 110. We are done for today. And so next episode, we'll kind of continue on with the Shakespeare series. And yeah, thank you all for joining. I hope you guys have a beautiful rest of your day and week. Enjoy the sunshine, because we will be getting a lot of it. And I will see you again next week. Thank you all for joining. I'll see you. Bye-bye.